In the shadow of the sword, the battle for global empire and the end of the ancient world, by Tom Holland. Do not look for a fight with the enemy. Beg God for peace and security. But if you do end up facing the enemy, then show endurance and remember that the gates of paradise lie in the shadow of the sword. Saying of Muhammad, as recorded by Sally Muslim. Part 1. Introduction. I shall include in my narrative only those things by which first we ourselves, then later generations, may benefit. Eusebius, The History of the Church. The degree of authority one can give to the evangelists about the life of Christ is relatively small, whereas for the life of Muhammad, we know everything, more or less. We know where he lived, what his economic situation was, who he fell in love with. We know a great deal about the political circumstances and the socio-economic circumstances of the time. Salman Rushdie. Chapter 1. Known Unknowns. Between Two Worlds. Yusuf Asar Yathar, an Arab king celebrated for his long hair, his piety, and his utter ruthlessness, had been brought to defeat. Leaving the reek of the battlefield, he rode his blood-flecked white charger down to the very edge of the Red Sea. Behind him, he knew, Christian outliers would already be advancing against his palace, to seize his treasury, to capture his queen. Certainly his conquerors had no cause to show him mercy. Few were more notorious among the Christians than Yusuf. 2 years previously, looking to secure the southwest of Arabia for his own faith, he had captured their regional stronghold of Najran. What had happened next was a matter of shock and horror to Christians far beyond the limits of Himyar, the kingdom on the Red Sea that Yusuf had ruled on and off for just under a decade. The local church, with the bishop and a great multitude of his followers locked inside, had been put to the torch. A group of virgins, hurrying to join them, had hurled themselves onto the flames, crying defiantly as they did so how sweet it was to breathe in the scent of burning priests. Another woman, whose face no one had ever seen outside the door of her house and who had never walked during the day in the city, had torn off her headscarf, the better to reproach the king. Yusuf, in his fury, had ordered her daughter and granddaughter killed before her, their blood poured down her throat, and then her own head to be sent flying. Martyrdoms such as these, fated though they were by the church, could not readily be forgiven. A great army, crossing from the Christian kingdom of Ethiopia, had duly landed in Himyar. The defenders had been cornered, engaged, and routed. Now, with the shallows of the Red Sea lapping at his horse's hooves, Yusuf had come to the end of the road. Not all his obedience to the laws granted to God's chosen prophet had been sufficient to save him from ruin. Slowly, he urged his horse forwards, breasting the water, until at last, weighed down by his armour, he disappeared beneath the waves. So perished Yusuf Asar Yathar, the last Jewish king ever to rule in Arabia. The collapse of the kingdom of the Himyarites in AD 525 is not, it is fair to say, one of the more celebrated episodes of ancient history. Himyar itself, despite having prospered for some 6 centuries until its final overthrow under Yusuf, lacks the ready brand recognition today of a Babylon or an Athens or a Rome. Unsurprisingly so, perhaps, for southern Arabia, then as now, was firmly peripheral to the major centres of civilization. Even the Arabs themselves, whom the peoples of more settled lands tended to dismiss as notorious brutes, of all the nations of the earth the most despised and insignificant, might look askance at the presumed barbarities of the region. The Himyarites, so one Arab poet reported in shocked tones, left their women uncircumcised, and do not think it disgusting to eat locusts. Behaviour that clearly branded them as beyond the pale. Yet, It's not only in terms of its geography that Himyar seems to lie in shadow. Similarly obscure is the period in which the death of Yusuf occurred. The 6th century AD defies precise categorization. It seems to stand between two ages. If it looks back to the world of classical civilization, then so also does it look forward to the world of the Crusades. Historians categorize it, and the centuries either side of it, as late antiquity, a phrase that conveys a sense of lengthening shadows and the Middle Ages soon to come. For anyone accustomed to thinking of history as a succession of neatly defined and self-enclosed epochs, there is something vaguely unsettling about this. Rather like the scientist in the classic horror film The Fly, who ends up a mutant combination of human and insect, the world of late antiquity can seem, from our own perspective, peculiarly hybrid. Far beyond the borders of Yusuf's Himyarite kingdom, empires raised on fabulously ancient foundations still dominated the Near East and the Mediterranean, as they had done for centuries. Yet their very age served only to highlight how profoundly they were coming to slip the moorings of their past. Take, for instance, the region immediately to the north of Arabia, the land we know today as Iraq. Here, across mud flats that had witnessed the dawn of urban civilization, loyalty was owed to a king who was, just as his predecessor had been a whole millennium previously, a Persian. His dominions, like those of the Persian Empire that had existed 1,000 years before, stretched eastwards to the frontiers of India and deep into Central Asia. The splendours of the court over which he presided, the magnificence of its rituals, and the immodesty of his pretensions, all would have been perfectly familiar to a king of Babylon. That this was so, however, had been almost forgotten by the people of Iraq themselves. A spreading amnesia was blotting out memories that had endured for millennia. Even the Persians, far from venerating the truth about their glorious imperial heritage, had begun to obscure and distort it. The legacy of Iraq's incomparable history lived on, preserved in the Persians' fantasies of global rule, and in the many glories that lent such fantasies credence. But, increasingly, it wore the look not of ages departed, but of something new. Other superpowers were less neglectful of their pasts. The great cities of the Mediterranean, built of stone and marble rather than the mud bricks favoured by the people of Iraq, were less prone to crumbling into dust. The empire that ruled them likewise wore, in 525, a veneer of venerable indestructibility. Even to the Persians, Roman might appeared something primordial. "God so arranged things," they would occasionally acknowledge, albeit through gritted teeth, "that the whole world was lit up from the beginning by two eyes, namely, by the wise rulers of the Persian realm and by the powerful empire of the Romans." Nevertheless, the Romans themselves, although certainly never averse to flattery, knew better. Rather than believing that their empire had existed since the dawn of time, they knew perfectly well that all its greatness had evolved from nothing. To trace the course of that evolution might therefore be to fathom the secrets of its success. Even as Yusuf was vanishing into the Red Sea, plans were being laid in the Roman capital for an immense ransacking of libraries and archives, an unprecedented labour of scholarship whose goal was the preservation for all eternity of the empire's vast inheritance of laws. This was no arid, merely antiquarian project. History, no less than armies or gold, had come to function as one of the sinews of the Roman state. It offered the empire reassurance that it was precisely what it claimed to be, the model of human order. How, then, was the prestige of Caesar to be maintained, if not by a perpetual trumpeting of Rome's triumphant antiquity? The challenge for Roman policymakers, of course, was that the glories of the past did not necessarily provide them with a reliable guide for the future. Indisputably, the empire remained what it had been for almost a millennium, the most formidable superpower of all, Wealthier and more populous than its great Persian rival, its hold over the eastern Mediterranean, always the richer half, appeared secure. From the mountains of the Balkans to the deserts of Egypt, Caesar ruled them all. Nevertheless, it was clearly an embarrassment, to put it mildly, that what had once been the western half of Rome's empire had ceased, by 525, to be Roman at all. Over the course of the previous century, an immense swathe of her holdings, like a sandcastle battered by the waves of an incoming tide, had crumbled utterly away. Britain had been lost as early as 410. Other provinces, over the succeeding decades, had followed. By the end of the century, the entire western half of the empire, even Italy, even Rome itself, had gone. In place of the venerable imperial order, there was now a patchwork of independent kingdoms, all of them, with the exception of a few in western Britain, ruled by warrior elites from beyond the limits of the former empire. The relationship that existed between the natives and these barbarian newcomers varied from realm to realm. Some, like the Britons, fought the invaders tooth and nail. Others, like the Italians, were given to hailing them as though they were Caesars. Yet in every case, the empire's collapse resulted in the forging of new identities, new values, new presumptions. These, over the long term, would lead to the establishment of a radically new political order in Western Europe. Rome's abandoned provinces would never again acknowledge a single master. Time would see both the great empires of the age, the Persian as well as the Roman, go the way of Nineveh and Tyre. Not so the states established in Rome's western provinces, some of which still commemorate in their modern names the intrusions back in late antiquity of barbarian war bands. Small wonder, then, that European historians have traditionally seen the arrival of the Franks in the land that would eventually become France, and of the Angles in the future England, as events of far greater long-term significance than the activities of any Caesar or Persian king. We now know, as their contemporaries did not, that ruin was stalking both the rival empires. A century on from the collapse of the Himyarite kingdom, and the two superpowers were staring into the abyss. That the Persian Empire would end up toppled completely, while that of the Romans was left as little more than a mangled trunk, has traditionally served to mark them as dead ends, bed blockers, dinosaurs. How tempting it is to presume, then, that they must have perished of decrepitude and old age. The lateness of late antiquity, to those who trace in it only a calamitous arc of decline and fall, has the quality of dinner guests who refuse to get their coats once the party is over. Except that the empires raised by the peoples of the age were not solely of this earth. Radiant though a Caesar might appear to his subjects, awesomely though his palaces and citadels might tower above the common run, and remorselessly though his array of soldiers and bureaucrats and tax collectors might serve his will, yet even he was merely a mortal, in a cosmos governed by a celestial king. There was only one universal monarch, and that was God. This presumption, by the time that Yusuf was brought to bay early in the 6th century AD, was one virtually unchallenged across the entire sweep of the Near East, and it affected almost every aspect of geopolitics in the region. When Yusuf clashed with the Ethiopian invaders, far more was at stake than the petty ambitions of squabbling warlords. The interests of heaven as well had been intimately involved. Between those fighting in the Jewish cause and those in the name of Christ, the differences were so profound as to be irreconcilable. Confident, though both sides were, that the God they worshipped was the only God, Monos Theos in Greek, this shared conviction only rendered them all the more implacably opposed. Not just in southern Arabia, but across the entire span of the civilized world, devotion to a particular understanding of the divine had become an emotion that defined the lives of millions upon millions of people. In an age when realms might crest and fall like the spume of a wave, and even great empires totter, there was certainly no earthly power that could command such allegiance. Identity was coming to be defined not by the kingdoms of this world, but by various conceptions of the one, the only God, by monotheisms. This development signalled a transformation of human society with incalculable consequences for the future. Of all the various features of the modern world that can be traced back to antiquity, alphabets, democracy, gladiator films, none, perhaps, has been more globally influential than the establishment, for the first time in history, of various brands of monotheism as state religions. At the start of the third millennium since the birth of Christ, some 3.5 billion people, over half the population of the world, identify themselves with one or other of the various religions that assumed something approaching their modern form in the 250 years either side of Yusuf's death. The period of late antiquity, then, unfamiliar though it may be in comparison to other epochs of history, is no less pregnant with relevance for that. Wherever men or women are inspired by a belief in a single God to think or to behave in a certain way, they demonstrate its abiding influence. The impact of the revolution that it witnessed still reverberates today. It is the ambition of this book to trace the origins and the progress of that same revolution. How was it that the patterns of people's thought, over the course of only a few centuries, came to be altered so radically and so enduringly? The story is a richly human one, replete with vivid drama, extraordinary characters, and often riotous colour. Yet, it is also one that imposes peculiar demands upon the historian, for much of it takes place in a dimension beyond the physical. It features kings, but also angels, warlords, but also demons. Consequently, not every event in the pages that follow can be explained purely in terms of material self-interest or political calculation. Shadowing the often brutally vivid world of mortal affairs is a dimension that is heaven-lit and damnation-haunted. Certainly, when Yusuf's contemporaries analysed his downfall, they were not naive in their analysis. They recognised that complex issues of trade policy and the rivalries of the two distant superpowers had been lurking in the background. Yet they never doubted that the sands of Arabia had become the stage for an authentically celestial drama. The forces of heaven and hell had met and clashed. It was a matter of opinion whether Yusuf was on the side of the angels or the demons, but neither Jews nor Christians had any doubt that what had happened had derived ultimately from God. This was the core presumption of the age, and a history of late antiquity that neglects to pay due acknowledgement to it is a history that has failed. The beliefs of the period must therefore be treated with both seriousness and empathy. Yet this does not mean that their claim should be taken wholly at face value. Back in the early 4th century, a Palestinian bishop by the name of Eusebius wrote a history of the early church. In it, he initiated a tradition of historical inquiry that explained the past as the tracing of patterns upon time by the forefinger of God. This presumption, although stupendously influential, and not merely among Christian authors, fell out of fashion in the West several centuries ago. Whatever their personal religious convictions may be, modern historians do not generally explain past events as the workings of divine providence. All aspects of human society, even beliefs themselves, are now presumed to be products of evolution. Nor is this a uniquely modern perspective. Eusebius himself, 1500 years before Darwin, had recognized in it a pernicious and peculiarly threatening heresy. Nothing was more alarming to him than the notion propagated by the enemies of his faith that it was something upstart and contingent, a mere distorted echo of more venerable traditions. His history, far from tracing changes in the doctrines and institutions of the Church, aimed to demonstrate that they had never changed in the slightest. And Christianity itself? Christianity, Eusebius presumed, had existed since the dawn of time. For, Obviously, we must regard the religion proclaimed in recent years to every nation through Christ's teaching as none other than the first, the most ancient, and the most primitive of religions. To many of us today, familiar as we are with Neanderthal burial sites and Cro-Magnon cave art, this claim does not seem obvious at all. Nevertheless, its underlying presumption that religions have some mysterious and fundamental essence immune to the processes of time remains widely taken for granted. In large part, this is due to Eusebius and others like him. The great innovation of late antiquity was to fashion, out of what might otherwise have been an incohate blur of beliefs and doctrines, individual templates for individual religions, and then to establish them as definitive. How this was accomplished is a fascinating and remarkable tale, for it touches upon the highest politics and the profoundest human emotions. The clash of great empires and the wretchedness of slaves, the shimmering of mosaics and the stench of plague pits, the clamour of teeming cities and the silence of empty deserts, all must feature. Beginning in a world recognisably ancient and ending in one medieval, it ranks as a transformation as momentous as any in history. Yet the story is, for all that, a treacherous one to tell. Partly this is due to the inevitable gaps and contradictions in the sources that bedevil all periods of ancient history. Take, for example, the story of Yusuf's death. There are some accounts which describe him as falling in the heat of battle, rather than riding out into the sea. More problematic still is the bias in our sources, almost all of which are Christian. Even the chronology is a muddle, with some historians dating Yusuf's death not at 525, but to 520. All these, it might be thought, are mere problems of detail, except that there is an additional and much greater complication. Any history tracing the development of rival monotheisms cannot help but use such words as Christian and Jew. And yet, as the story of Yusuf suggests, these did not necessarily mean in late antiquity what they have come to mean today. A narrative that features the persecution of veiled Christian women in Arabia by a Jewish king is clearly one set in a world at some remove from our own. It is for this reason that the story of late antiquity is altogether stranger and more surprising than might at first appear. Indeed, it is precisely the measure of those who shaped it to such stupefying effect that they succeeded so well in veiling their own astounding creativity. In every period, of course, there are those who labour to redraft the past in the service of the present, but none perhaps has done it so potently, or to such enduring effect, as the historians of late antiquity. The supreme achievement of the Jewish and Christian scholars of the age was to craft a history of their respective faiths that cast themselves as its rightful and inevitable culmination, and left anything that might have served to contradict such an impression out of the story altogether. Whoever Moses might truly have been, and whether he even existed, most Jews' understanding of him today has been incalculably influenced by the rabbis of late antiquity. Brilliantly learned and ingenious men who devoted entire centuries of effort to demonstrating that their greatest prophet, no matter how far removed from them in time, had in fact been someone very much like themselves. Similarly, whatever Jesus might truly have believed himself to be, the Christian understanding of his mission and divinity, as taught by the vast majority of today's churches, bears witness to the turbulent ebb and flow of late Roman politics, to the exhaustive efforts of bishops and emperors to fashion a creed that could unite all of God's people as one. The essential architecture of Judaism and Christianity, no matter how far back in time its ultimate origins may stretch, was designed in late antiquity. Only faith, or the lack of it, can ultimately answer the great questions that lie at the heart of these religions: whether the Jews are truly God's chosen people, and whether Jesus did in reality rise from the dead. Much the same, however, could be said of other puzzles too. how and why the Jewish belief in a single God first evolved, and what might have been the full range of doctrines in the early church. Some of the sparks that first ignited the flames of Jewish and Christian practice can be glimpsed by the historian, but many more cannot. We see through a glass darkly, and that glass, by and large, was fashioned by the men and women who are the protagonists of this book. Granted, it was hardly a novel paradox that veneration of a primordial past might lead to its being masked, or even obliterated altogether. Many a wealthy patron in the ancient world flaunted his piety by erecting a colossal edifice over a modest shrine. The Jewish and Christian scholars of late antiquity, however, by the sheer force of their labours, succeeded in performing an infinitely more enduring feat of renovation. Their ultimate achievement was to craft an interpretation not only of their own various forms of monotheism, but of religion itself. An interpretation that billions of people now take for granted as the supreme influence affecting both their behaviour on this earth and the eternal destiny of their souls. It is this that makes the project of sifting through the writings of late antiquity for evidence of what might actually have happened so sensitive, and so fascinating as well. Such a project, it goes without saying, is not one to be undertaken lightly. Nor, the complexity and ambiguity of these sources being what they are, can the story that is this book's theme be narrated without a prior explanation of how and why it is being told in the way it is. That is why, before I embark on telling it, I pause to tell something quite else. The making of a story. The greatest story ever told. Winners were the favourites of heaven. Even Christians, whose God had died as a convicted criminal, nailed to a wooden cross, might succumb to this presumption. Eusebius certainly took it for granted. How could he not have done, when he had the spectacle before him of a Roman state that for centuries had been gore-streaked with Christian blood, miraculously transformed into a bulwark of the Church? No need for the Caesar, who had first bowed his head before Christ, to wait for death to receive his due reward. Eusebius, who combined the talents of an instinctive polemicist with a profound streak of hero worship, wrote an entire biography of the emperor just to ram the point home. So dear was he to God, and so blessed, so pious, and so fortunate in all he undertook, that with the greatest facility he obtained authority over more nations than any who had preceded him, and yet retained his power undisturbed to the very close of his life. Confidence in this formula, that faith in Christ would lead to earthly glory, would take a number of knocks over the course of the succeeding centuries. Awkwardly, the more Christian the Romans became, the more their empire's frontiers seemed to contract. Theologians devised various explanations for this puzzling phenomenon. Explanations which Christians, who had only to study the Gospels to learn Jesus' views on the earthly and the overweening, might well find perfectly persuasive. Nevertheless, the core equation so lovingly dwelt upon by Eusebius, that worldly greatness was bestowed by God upon those who pleased him, appeared altogether too plausible simply to be dismissed out of hand. Instead, the more the Romans found themselves locked in a desperate struggle for survival, so the more it came to be appropriated by a new and quite startlingly upstart imperial people. The identity of these same conquerors, who had not only deprived the Romans of their wealthiest provinces, but had crushed the Persians underfoot altogether, could hardly have come as more of a shock to the defeated. Indeed, so unexpected was what had happened, so utterly jaw-dropping as to appear self-evidently miraculous. What else but the hand of God could possibly explain the conquest of the world by a people previously scorned as the ultimate in savagery and backwardness? The Arabs. Half a millennium on from the time of Eusebius at the start of the 9th Christian century, and the close identification made by the learned between piety and worldly power still enjoyed spectacular traction. Christians themselves might have grown uncomfortable with the notion, but not so the Arabs, who rejoiced in a rampant conviction that all their astounding victories were owed directly to the favour of God. 2 centuries previously, so they believed, heaven had graced their ancestors with a stream of supernatural revelations, a dispensation that trumped those of the Jews and the Christians, and had set those who subjected themselves to it upon a road to global empire. Indeed, 800 years after the birth of Christ, it was as Muslims, those who submit to God, that most Arabs had come to identify themselves. The vast agglomeration of territories won by the swords of their forefathers, stretching from the shores of the Atlantic to the fringes of China, served as the ultimate monument to what God had demanded of them, their submission. Islam, they called it, shorthand for what had become, by the early 9th century, an entire civilization. It was not only the Arabs themselves, however, who had been granted a rare new dignity by the coming of Islam. So too had their language. It was in Arabic, so Muslims believed, that God had climactically and for all time revealed his purposes to humanity. What was good enough for the Almighty, it went without saying, was good enough for mortals. By AD 800, so redeemed was Arabic from the contempt in which it had once been held, that its sound had come to rank as the very music of power, and its cursives as things of pure beauty, refined to a rare and exquisite perfection by the art of its calligraphers. Among the Arabs, the written word was on the verge of becoming a mania. One scholar, when he died in 822, left behind him a library that filled a whole 600 trunks. Another was said to have been flattened to a pulp when a tower of books collapsed on top of him while he was drunk. The story does not seem wholly implausible. One volume of Arab history, it is claimed, stretched to almost 80,000 pages, which would have made for a crushing weight, to be sure. Clearly, then, a people who could boast of such titanic literary endeavours were far removed from an age that had scorned them as barbarians, as the Arabs themselves delighted in pointing out. The sense of compulsion they brought to the study of their past was hardly surprising. The yearning to understand the reason for the spectacular upsurge in their fortunes, to clarify the process by which it had been brought about, and to elucidate what it revealed about the character of their god, never ceased to gnaw. Just as Eusebius, 500 years previously, had sought answers to very similar questions in the life of a Roman emperor, so now did Ibn Hisham, a scholar originally from Iraq, who by the early 9th century had settled in Egypt, likewise turn to biography in order to fathom the purposes of heaven. Sira, he termed his chosen genre, exemplary behaviour. It was less what his subject had done that concerned Ibn Hisham than how he had done it. There was an urgent reason for this. The hero of Ibn Hisham's biography, so Muslims believed, offered the ultimate in role models. God had chosen him to serve as his mouthpiece. It was through him that the All-Merciful had revealed his wishes to the Arabs and graced them with those same revelations that had then inspired them, 2 centuries before the time of Ibn Hisham, to erupt from their deserts and tear the world's superpowers to pieces. We are God's helpers and the assistants of his prophet, and will fight men until they believe in God. And he who believes in God and his prophet has protected his life and property from us. And he who disbelieves, we will fight in God unceasingly, and killing him will be a small matter to us. This, according to Ibn Hisham, was the swaggering manifesto promoted by Arab warriors on the eve of their conquest of the world. But who precisely was this prophet? Ibn Hisham's aim was to provide the answer. Sitting in Egypt, surrounded by the ruins of forgotten and superseded civilizations, he regarded his Sira not merely as a biography, but as a record of the most momentous revolution in history. Its subject was a man who had died only 2 years before the dismemberment of the Roman and Persian empires had begun, an Arab by the name of Muhammad. Aged 40 and with a moderate career as a merchant behind him, he had experienced, if Ibn Husham were to be believed, history's most epochal midlife crisis. Restless and dissatisfied, he had begun to roam the wilderness which stretched beyond his hometown, and not a stone or tree that he passed by but would say, "Peace be unto you, O Prophet of God." Muhammad, understandably enough, had been left most unsettled. Voices were rarely heard in the places where he chose to wander, on his lonely quest after spiritual enlightenment. Mecca, the nearby town, stood in the depths of the Arabian desert, the ring of mountains that surrounded it, baked black by the pitilessly broiling sun, rose barren, wind-lashed and empty. Yet it was on the slope of one of those same mountains, lying at night inside a cave, that Muhammad heard the most startling voice of all. He felt it at first as a vice tightening around his body, the grip of some terrifying supernatural entity. Next came a single command: recite. Then, as though his words were a desperate, violent exhalation of air, Muhammad himself started to gasp out whole lines of verse.
Recite, in the name of your Lord, He who created. He created man from a blood clot. Recite, your Lord is most bountiful. He taught with the pen. He taught man what he knew not.
Muhammad was speaking, but the words were not his own. Then whose? Muhammad himself, it is said, initially suspected a jinn, a spirit of the deserts and winds. Perhaps this was not surprising. Mecca was, according to Ibn Hisham, a hag-ridden, demon-haunted place. Right in the centre of the city there stood a shrine built of stone and mud, the Kaaba, or cube, in which there squatted a whole host of fearsome gods, totems of such sinister power that men from across Arabia would gather there to pay their respects. On top of these, every household in Mecca had its own private idol, there to be rubbed against for luck before a journey. So inveterately pagan were the Meccans that they even offered sacrifices to boulders, among which were a couple of one-time lovers who had dared to have sex in the Kaaba and promptly been turned to rock. It was only natural, then, in a city so eerie, so perfumed by blood and magic, that clairvoyance should have been a common sight, rolling about in the dirt of its narrow streets, vomiting up revelations, possessed by jinn in the depths of their guts. So overwhelming was Muhammad's dread that he might now be suffering an identical fate that he thought to take his life. Rising to his feet, he left the cave and stumbled out into the night. Up the side of the mountain he hurried. Heading for the summit, he prepared to hurl himself from the peak, to dash himself onto the rocks. But now the voice returned.
O Muhammad, thou art the apostle of God, and I am Gabriel.
Could it really be so? Gabriel was a mighty angel, the messenger of the one God worshipped by the Jews and the Christians, who, back in ancient times, or so it was said, had revealed visions to the prophet Daniel and told the Virgin Mary that she was to bear a son. Looking up to the heavens, Muhammad saw the figure of a man, his feet astride the horizon. Who else but the angel himself? Returning down the mountain, seeking comfort from his wife, reflecting upon the shattering trauma he had been through, Muhammad dared to contemplate a truly awesome possibility, that the voice had spoken the truth. He would not hear it again for another 2 years, but when at last Gabriel returned and the silence was broken, Muhammad had no doubt that he was hearing, courtesy of the angel, the authentic words of a god, and not just any god, but the one God, the true God, the indivisible God. There is no God but He, creator of all things. Here, in this uncompromising assertion that there existed only a single divinity, lay the key to a starkly new vision of the universe, monotheism in the raw. With each successive revelation, Muhammad's understanding of God's oneness, and of what was owed to him as a result, was burnished to an ever more awesome sheen. The people of Arabia, with their idols of stone or wood or dates mixed with rancid butter, were merely repeating what had been, since the dawn of time, humanity's greatest delusion, that the heavens and the earth were thronged with a whole teeming mob of gods. So Muhammad, ordered by his voice to proclaim aloud God's revelations, began to preach. Again and again, he warned, mankind had succumbed to the one sin that could not be forgiven. Shirk. The belief that God can be associated with other beings. Again and again, however, because he was all-merciful, the Lord of the worlds had sent prophets to open the eyes of people to their folly, and summon them back to the primordial way of truth. Noah and Abraham, Moses and Jesus, all had preached the one identical message, a call for submission to God. Now, it appeared, with revelations being granted to Muhammad in ever-increasing length and number, there had arisen, 6 centuries after Jesus, a new prophet. Indeed, the very seal of prophets. As the years passed and the divine continued to speak through him, so Muhammad and his growing band of followers came to realize that he was the recipient of the ultimate in messages, the definitive revelation of God. Not that everyone concurred. Prophecy, as Ibn Hisham would sagely observe, is a troublesome burden. Only strong, resolute messengers can bear it by God's help and grace, because of the opposition which they meet from men in conveying God's message. Which was putting it mildly. Muhammad's fellow townsmen regarded him first as a diversion, then as a provocation, and finally as a mortal danger. Particularly outraged by his uncompromising message were the members of his own tribe, Quraysh, as they were known, a consortium of clans who had long enjoyed a peculiar respect among the scattered tribes of Arabia. The prestige they enjoyed as a people of God reflected the lucrative role that the Quraysh had grasped for themselves as the guardians of the Kaaba and its multitude of idols, a role that Muhammad, with his wild talk of there being only a single God, seemed determined to sabotage. The unsurprising consequence was that Mecca grew increasingly hot for the Prophet and his followers. By AD 622, 12 years after the first revelation had descended from the heavens, the threat was directly to their lives. One night, Gabriel appeared to the Prophet and warned him that the Quraysh were plotting to murder him in his bed. The time had come to leave. Following in the footsteps of his followers, many of whom had already abandoned Mecca, Muhammad obediently slipped out from the city and vanished into the night. The moment had been long anticipated. What the Prophet had now embarked upon was not some aimless flight into the wilds of the desert, but rather a meticulously planned migration. A hijra. An escape that would come to be seen in due course as having transformed the entire order of time. The year in which it took place still serves Muslims to this day as year 1. Dates in their calendar continue to be defined as AH, or Anno Hijri, in the year of the Hijra. To Ibn Hisham, the central episode of Muhammad's life was not his first revelation, but his departure from Mecca. No longer simply a preacher, he was now embarked upon a spectacular series of exploits that would see him emerge in due course as the leader of an entire new political order. His destination, an oasis to the north of Mecca known as Yathrib, stood in desperate need of a guiding hand. The tribes who lived there, an uneasy mixture of Jewish and Arab settlers, had long been great enthusiasts for savage feuding, but increasingly, as the violence spiraled ever more out of control, there were many weary of the perpetual bloodshed. Pressure was building in Yathrib to find a peacemaker, someone neutral, someone trustworthy, someone authoritative, someone perhaps, just perhaps, with a channel direct to God. In short, between Muhammad, a prophet in need of a refuge, and Yathrib, a city in need of a prophet, there could hardly have been a more perfect fit. A match made literally in heaven, as Ibn Hisham would choose to cast it. It is the measure of what Muhammad ultimately achieved in Yathrib that its very name would end up erased from the map. It was the fate and the undying glory of the oasis that had offered him sanctuary to be commemorated as the City of the Prophet, or Madinat an-Nabi, Medina. Muhammad would spend the rest of his life there, building a society that has served as the model for Muslims ever since. Angry and clear was the reproach delivered by the Prophet to those who lived by the murderous ethics of the desert. To love gold with a love inordinate, to steal from orphans and squander their inheritance, and to dispose of unwanted daughters by burying them alive in the sands was, so Muhammad warned, to be bound for eternal fire. Account is demanded of those who oppress people and commit transgression on earth unjustly. To them there is painful torment. Before the awesome infinitude of God, enthroned upon his judgment seat, even the haughtiest or most rumbustuous clan chief was but the merest speck of dust. The squabbling tribes of Yathrib, overwhelmed by the flood tide of Muhammad's revelations, increasingly found their old antagonisms and their old loyalties dissolving amid the urgency and grandeur of his message. Yet the Prophet, even as he tamed their addiction to the more traditional pleasures of chauvinism, did not think to deny them all sense of community. On the contrary, although Muhammad would certainly succeed in bringing peace to his oasis refuge, just as he had been invited to do, peace was hardly the limit of what he brought. Something more, very much more, was on offer to the people of Yathrib. A radically new identity, forged out of the whirling atoms of their pulverized tribal order. An identity as a single people, as the members of a single ummah. Seal of the prophets, Muhammad may have been, but he did not disdain to found an earthly state. God continued to speak to him. His self-confidence did not dim. Obstacles in his path were swept aside or else trampled down. When the gap between rich and poor, which offended Muhammad to the core of his being, refused to narrow, he summarily outlawed usury and established an equitable taxation system. When the Jews of Yathrib, disconcerted by the transformation of their hometown into the City of the Prophet, presumed to manoeuvre against him, they were variously expelled, enslaved, or massacred. When the Quraysh, informed that Muhammad was planning to raid one of their caravans, sent a military escort out into the desert, it was met by the Prophet and his tiny band of followers beside a watering hole named Badr, and put humiliatingly to rout. Angels, white turbans flowing behind them, shimmered in the sky above the battlefield, flashing their fiery swords and sending the Qurayshi heads flying. Most spectacular and irrefutable sign of God's favour, however, was the transformation of Muhammad in no more than a decade from refugee to effective master of Arabia. He led 27 campaigns in all, according to Ibn Hisham, and if occasionally there was a defeat, and if the angels by and large chose not to fight as they had done at Badr, but rather to serve him as a reserve, then perhaps his ultimate triumph could be considered only the more extraordinary for it. By 632, the traditional date of his death, paganism in Arabia had everywhere been put in shadow. Sweetest moment of all had been the conquest 2 years previously of Mecca itself. Riding into his hometown, Muhammad had ordered the Kaaba stripped of its gods. A great bonfire had been lit. The toppled idols had been consigned to its flames. The devil, summoning his progeny around him, had cried out in woe, "Abandon all hope that the community of Muhammad will ever revert to shirk after this day of theirs." Well mighty of Yald, the venerable sanctuary, that preeminent bastion of paganism, had been brought at last to a due submission to Islam. This consecration of Mecca to the service of the one true God, however, was far from an innovation. What Muhammad had done, so he revealed to his followers, was restore the shrine to its primordial, pristine state. God made Mecca holy the day he created heaven and earth. It is the holy of holies until the resurrection day. This assurance, even in the bleak days following Muhammad's death 2 years later, offered the faithful much comfort. It suggested to them that they had not been abandoned by God. Despite the loss of their prophet, Arabia remained transfigured by the sacred still. Nor was it only Mecca, the holy of holies, that still endured upon the face of the earth. So too did the Ummah, and to the greater glory of all that the prophet had taught. Over the succeeding years, the succeeding decades, the succeeding centuries, the Muslim people would serve to make of the entire world a Kaaba, conquered, cleansed, and sanctified. By the time that Ibn Hisham sat down to write his biography, it was not only Arabs who faced Mecca as they prayed. Strange peoples, of whom the prophet had possibly never even heard, Visigoths and Berbers, Sogdians and Parthians, could all be seen treading the sands of Arabia, pilgrims bound for the Kaaba. Although Ibn Hisham himself did not touch upon this phenomenon in his Sirah, there was no shortage of other scholars eager to relate the extraordinary conquests, far beyond the limits of Arabia, that followed the death of the prophet. Such relish was hardly surprising. Back in the wild days of their paganism, nothing had delighted the Arabs more than a spot of loud-mouthed boasting, be it about some heroic feat of arms, some stirring deed of banditry, or some glorious humiliation forced upon a rival. Now, when they blew their own trumpets, it was all in the cause of God. From Badr to the ends of the world, the story of Islam had been one of storming military triumph. Cities infinitely greater than Mecca had been captured. Peoples infinitely mightier than the Quraysh obliged to bow their necks. The scale of these victories, won in the teeth of ancient empires and venerable religions, surely furnished all the proof that anyone might need of the truth of the prophet's claims. "This is a sign that God loves us," as one exultant Arab put it, "and is pleased with our faith, namely, that he has given us dominion over all peoples and religions." And yet, all the while, there was anxiety. Even amid the wealth and splendour of a great empire, vast on a scale beyond anything that Muhammad would have imagined possible, the Muslim people could not shake off an uncomfortable sense of their own decay. A generation after Ibn Hisham had completed his biography, and the scholar who would end up crushed to death beneath his toppled books, an astounding polymath by the name of Al-Jahiz could view the entire triumphant course of Islam's history as embodying nothing but a dying fall. There had been only the one truly golden age. Those who had heard the prophet actually talk, who had ridden by his side, who had served him as his sahaba, or companions, they alone could be reckoned to have practiced the authentic monotheism. Hence, of course, their astounding success. It was their generation, fresh from the burial of the prophet, which had first embarked upon the conquest of the world, and achieved it, what was more. The men who had presided over this glorious victory charge, a sequence of leaders known as caliphs, or successors of the prophet, had all of them been noted intimates of Muhammad. The first, a grizzled veteran by the name of Abu Bakr, had been his companion during the perilous flight to Medina, and the father of his favourite wife. The second, Umar, had been his brother-in-law. The third, Uthman, had been married to one of his daughters. The fourth, Ali ibn Abi Talib, had rejoiced in the most splendid pedigree of all, the first male ever to convert to Islam, a step he had taken at the precocious age of 9. He was also the prophet's cousin, before finally graduating to become, just for good measure, his son-in-law as well. These four men had reigned for just 30 years in total, but already, by the time that Al-Jahiz was putting pen to paper, They were well on their way to being enshrined by the vast majority of Muslims as veritable paragons, Ar-Rashidun, or the rightly guided. Not, of course, that their period in power could quite compare with Muhammad's at Medina, but still, as a golden age, it came in a glorious second. For at that time, as Al-Jahiz put it wistfully, there was nothing in the way of offending action or scandalous innovation, no act of disobedience, envy, rancor, or rivalry. Islam had been pristinely Islamic still. But after every summer, there must be a winter, and after every golden age, an age of iron. In 661, the era of the Rashidun was brought to a bloody and tragic end. The Caliph Ali was murdered. Then, 2 decades later, his son was cut down in battle. Lips that had kissed the Prophet were prodded mockingly by a conqueror's stick. By now, a dynasty of Qurayshi despots, the Umayyads, had dug their claws deep into the caliphate and made it their own, to the scandal of the God-fearing. The new caliphs drank wine, they kept pet monkeys, they turned themselves not the Prophet's successors, but the deputies of God. Monstrous behaviour such as this was bound to tempt the wrath of heaven. And, sure enough, in 750, the Umayyads were toppled, forced to flee, and systematically hunted down by vengeful death squads. Nevertheless, the blots and stains of their near century in power were not so easily erased. No matter that the dynasty that succeeded them to the caliphal throne, the Abbasids, claimed descent from the uncle of Muhammad himself, the golden age of the Rashidun was not restored. Instead, no less than in the dark days that had preceded the coming of the Prophet, novelty and division seemed rife. Rival sects proliferated, and rival caliphs too. Meanwhile, beyond the palaces in which the successors of the Prophet dressed in silks and etched from plates of gold, the poor found themselves as oppressed as they had ever been by the arrogance of the powerful, the wealthy, the cruel. Remorselessly, the question nagged, how had it all gone wrong? And even more remorselessly, how was it best to set it right? 2 centuries on from the Hijra, and the last man to have seen the Prophet alive was long since departed from the face of the world. Nevertheless, confronted as they were by the splintering of the times, most Muslims knew that there could be no true solution to any problem that lacked the sanction of their beloved Prophet. In the Messenger of God, the Almighty himself had informed the faithful, you have an excellent example to follow. To sketch him was therefore to sketch the ultimate in role models, a pattern of behaviour fit to serve all mankind and all eternity. As the years went by, and ever more biographies were written in ever more extensive detail, so the Prophet came to be ever more venerated. That his birth had been marked by incontrovertible wonders, whether the appearance of strange stars in the sky or the whisperings of jinn in the ears of clairvoyance, foretelling a new age to come, had been well known to Ibn Hisham. But time would radically improve on this record of miracles. Fresh evidence, wholly unsuspected by Muhammad's earliest biographers, would see him revered as a man able to foretell the future, to receive messages from camels and palm trees and joints of meat, and to pick up a soldier's eyeball, reinsert it, and make it work better than before. The result was one yet additional miracle. The further in time from the Prophet a biographer, the more extensive his biography was likely to be. Not that it required a whole book to spell out a lesson from the life of Muhammad. A single anecdote, a single phrase would do. Hadiths, these snatches of biographical detail were termed, and already, a bare century after the time of Ibn Hisham, they existed in their tens, perhaps their hundreds of thousands. Anyone with a taste for lists could consult one of a number of vast compilations arranged neatly by subject. There was barely a topic, it seemed, on which Muhammad had not opined. Should the God-fearing wish to know whether